Person of the Week is brought to you by Citi. With global expertise and over two centuries of experience, Citi provides tools, insights, and guidance to help businesses thrive. They're not just any bank. They are Citi. Learn more at citi.com/wearecity.
Stories are always announcing themselves to everyone. I bet every single person who is listening to this probably had 15 ideas for a novel today. So it's not an issue of having ideas, but it is an issue of giving those ideas enough time in the subconscious that they begin to take on density and weight and begin to attract other ideas. And they sort of fold themselves together in the back of the mind into something that becomes a story. And then having the patience to wait until that story is full enough to attempt to put on the page.
Ever since her third novel, Fates and Furies, became a breakout hit in 2015, Lauren Groff has emerged as a singular voice in American fiction. She's a three-time National Book Award finalist, has won the Story Prize, and all five of her novels have been New York Times bestsellers. As one of the great novelists of the 21st century, it's no surprise that Lauren Groff is also one of our 2024 Time 100 honorees. Groff's two most recent novels, Matrix and The Vaster Wilds, explore themes of nature, spirituality, and utopian communities. Taken together, these works amount to a radical re-examination of how humans adapt to a rapidly changing natural world. Groff's ability to ask enormous spiritual questions while remaining grounded in specific characters makes her a unique voice in contemporary American fiction. Fates and Furies is one of my all-time favorite novels, and Matrix is one of the most compelling books I've read in years, which is why I was so excited to have her as a guest on our show this week. During our conversation, Groff and I talked about how her athleticism informs her work, the specifics of her childcare arrangement that allow her to get her writing done, and why time is the secret currency of art. I'm Charlotte Alter, senior correspondent for Time, and this is Person of the Week. So I understand from your time in college that you were both a French and an English major, but also a college athlete, and your sister is an Olympic athlete, so it clearly runs in the family. How do you incorporate this athleticism into your work?
So I think the life of the body is just as important to art as the life of the mind. And so I pay very intense attention to the body on a daily basis, not because, you know, I'm worried about weight or whatever. It's because it's the way that I regulate my own emotions. It's the way that I sort of retain focus and attention in the world. It's the way that I remember the exquisite beauty of the world. It's the quality of noticing that happens when you let your mind stop and you let the body take over. And that's really, really important. The other thing, too, is honestly, I'm really grateful to Title IX because I think my generation and your generation of women, when we were given the opportunity to play sports, sports became a way of understanding the world, knowing that everything is practice. I mean, once in a while you'll be asked to compete, but really it's not the competition that really matters. It's the daily slow incremental growth. And that is directly applicable to any kind of artwork. If you know, you're not doing it for the end product, you're doing it for the everyday engagement and the hard struggle to understand what it is that you want to do and to get to the other side. So I genuinely think that sports are magnificent, not for the performance, but for what they give you in the training and the day-to-day.
Interesting. So it sounds like what you're saying is that training as an athlete has some overlap with the writing process of just kind of like getting up and practicing and doing it.
Yeah, right. Not every day is going to be good, right?
Yeah. So
most days are actually going to be pretty painful. And, you know, you'll end up crying once in a while. But it feels good to feel yourself growing and getting more competent and getting stronger. And that can be the same in the work as it is in the body.
Yeah. So your career really took off with Fates and Furies, which I absolutely loved and couldn't put down. It was a New York Times bestseller and your first of three finalists for the National Book Award. What do you think worked about this novel? Why do you think it resonated so much with readers?
I just reread that book for the first time in 8 years. And there's a lot there that I really love, right? And there's a lot there that I would do differently. I'm not sure what happened with that book. I feel very grateful that it did find the readers that it found and continues to find, actually. I think that a lot of it was written out of rage, especially feminine rage. I think people are now writing a lot more about female rage in fiction, which I'm glad to see. Mm-hmm. And it has occurred in the past. It just hit its moment. You never know when a book comes into the world how it's going to be received, right? You just sort of put it out there, and sometimes it just sort of dissipates into the ether, and sometimes it catches. Who knows the magic of that? But it is magical when it happens, for sure.
And so, you know, President Obama called Fates and Furies his favorite book of the year that year. And I understand you have a letter that he wrote you. So what did he say when he wrote you about this novel?
Yeah, he wrote me this beautiful handwritten letter. And he just told me why he liked the book and why he responded to it. And I have to say, that was probably the most moving moment of my writerly life up to that point. It's a sitting president, one, to a person as intelligent and sensitive as Barack Obama, but also it's always beautiful to find your reader, right? Mm-hmm. It's always like extraordinary, no matter who the reader is, even if he's not a president, right? To have someone actually speak back into you and say, I get you, right? I get what you were trying to do and I appreciate it. That's just, it can light you up for a year at a time.
Yeah. And so this novel is about marriage. And that brings me to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is your own marriage. Because I understand you and your husband have developed this very unique partnership that supports the writing that you need to do. So can you tell me a little bit about how your own marriage supports your literary career?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I got extraordinarily lucky when I found Clay in college, right? I didn't know at the time that he was the magnificent, generous, Buddha-like person that he is, but he is. We have developed together a way to sort of allow the writing to be almost another human in the family. And one of the things that we figured out early on before the children came, when suddenly we were staring down the barrel of no more time. So time is the secret currency of art, right? The time that you need to just stare at a wall is so vast that anyone giving you that, that's a true boon.
Right.
We wanted to sit down and make a contract. I wanted to make a contract, an actual physical piece of paper that we wrote down all of the things that we were sort of separating into our domestic life so that we could protect this time around my vocation of writing.
Right.
So yeah, we have this beautiful contract. It means that I never have to get up in the morning with the children. I never have, other than when they were physically attached to me. And I don't take them to school. I don't make them breakfast. I don't see them in the morning. There are no humans for me in the morning other than, you know, the humans in the book. And that has become a very beautiful silent space for the work to get done.
Can you tell me what else is in this contract?
Yeah. So one of the things was he made me live in Florida, which I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
And so I was able to negotiate. I could go to a writer's colony for a month if I really wanted to. I could, you know, go do readings all across the country or in other countries if I want to. He does the taxes, thank God, right? Not that I couldn't do it. I'm actually competent as a human, but
I just
don't want to.
Of course you are. Yeah, I mean, that's like me with the trash. I just don't want to.
I just don't want to,
so
right? Why would you want to?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes we have to go back and look at it again and revise and say, like, he's been taking on so much, so maybe I need to take on more. That's usually the way it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really do want to drill into this idea of time as kind of the currency of artistic work, because I know so many people, particularly mothers, who have a really hard time carving out that time. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the process over the course of becoming a parent in which you realized that you needed this time, you needed it in this way, and here were the ways you were going to get that time?
Yeah, I mean, before the boys came, I would spend 12 hours a day alone in my room working, right? Either reading or writing, both of which were work. And I knew that that wasn't going to happen anymore. So that's why the contract happened. I also have to say, you know, I have to acknowledge like the privilege too, to be honest. I mean, this is a very real thing. I don't have to have another job other than writing. And I haven't since my first book advance, mm-hmm. right? So as soon as that happened, you know, I was able to pay for childcare as well. So there's a very real element of privilege here that I do not want to skate over whatsoever, because it doesn't happen for everyone. And it's not fair that it doesn't happen. I wish that we could give it to all writers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the other thing too is I do allow the boys to sort of slide back into my life when they come home from school, right? They sort of take center stage. They are the most important thing afterwards. But there is a kind of, I don't know if it's meanness, but it's a very adamantine pushing away that happens, which is probably not kind or generous in a way that we expect mothers to be kind and generous. I'm not saying that I regret it in any way, but it's very hard, right? I'm closing my door to my children when they were really little, when they were screaming. I would not go out there. Mm-hmm. I just let Clay take care of it. And he's competent. He can do it.
Yeah. Right?
They can do it. So there's this beautiful passage in Nathalie Sirot's book on her childhood where her own mother was a writer, and she remembers sort of being pushed away in some ways by her mother's dedication to her work. And it's a kind of this rigidity that for the rest of her life she's trying to overcome. And I think that I've done that to my boys. And there's nothing that you do as a parent that won't somehow affect the children, right? I'm not blaming myself for this at all, but I have been very, very rigid when it comes to the writing in a way that I think other people are not.
So how did you do this when you were pregnant and postpartum? Because once your kids are like not attached to you anymore, it's a little bit easier to make these kinds of arrangements. But what was your writing like during the periods of time when, you know, as you've said, you're very physically in tune, the experience of your body is very important to your work. What was pregnancy and postpartum like in that context?
Oh, it was horrendous. I didn't write anything good for a year. I just sat there, right? I sat there with my books, sometimes crying. I don't know why I did that to myself, other than the fact that for my own self, I had to maintain that space if the writing wanted to come to me. And it didn't at that time. That was a very fallow period. You know, eventually would start to read, and that reading sort of it fed the work as well. So the truth is there's no easy way, right? There's no easy way to be a parent and a writer, period. But especially when they're attached to you, especially when you're actually literally attached to them. So it's hard. But I guess one of the things that I have always felt is that my work is my first child, right? And that I never want to starve one child to feed another. So I know that the boys are going to get all the love, right? Plenty of love. But I need my first, more abstract, much more complicated child to also have enough love.
When we come back, Lauren Groff talks about climate change, why she prefers to write her book drafts by hand, and the future of publishing. More in a minute.
Person of the Week is brought to you by Citi. They're not an airline, but their network connects global businesses in nearly 160 local markets. They're not writers, but they help clients shape their financial story. With global expertise and over two centuries of experience, Citi provides tools, insights, and guidance to help businesses thrive. They're not just any bank. They're Citi. Learn more at citi.com/wearecity.
So I want to turn to your two most recent novels, including Matrix from 2021 and The Vaster Wilds, which came out in 2023. So these are both works of historical fiction. Can you tell us about your process for writing historical fiction? How do you decide on the time period and the events that you're going to depict? And specifically about Matrix, I was frankly surprised. No offense. I was surprised that I was so compelled by it because it is a novel about an obscure 12th century nun. I understand it's loosely based off of Marie de France, of whom very little is known about her real life. So why did you decide to write a novel about a 12th century nun who very few people know anything about?
In college, I fell in love with Marie de France because, you know, I took a course on Ancien Français, so Old French, and it was really wonderful. I just met her and I loved her. And I just have always loved this specter of an unknown Marie de France about whom we know that she was named Marie and she's from France and maybe an abbess, who knows. So it's always been in my mind to write about her, but it wasn't until I heard a friend of mine give a lecture. She gave this lecture on medieval nuns, and as I was in the audience, I actually was given the gift of Matrix, right? This is like the first time ever and probably the last that a book has sort of fallen whole into my head. But, you know, it was predicated on my deep love of and knowledge of Marie de France in the medieval ages. I also wanted to write a sexy book and a lesbian book, right? And I wanted to write a book in which zero men are actually like seen with clarity. They're sort of like a vague shifting shadow sort of undulating across the wall. And a lot of times I write a book because it makes me happy and it makes me laugh. And so I just wanted to be with these women, right? I just wanted to build a utopia, knowing that utopias contain within themselves the seeds of their own destruction, as all human endeavors do. I wanted to imagine a different path of female power than the one that I think we in the 21st century shrink medieval women into a very flattened version of what they could possibly be, right? There's either the illiterate woman who pumps out a lot of babies, or there's Eleanor of Aquitaine, who is amazing, right? She's an amazing actual person, but those are the two models we're given for medieval women. And I just sort of wanted to blow a little bit more air into this depiction and have fun with it. So the time period comes out of the story that I want to tell, to be perfectly honest. So I actually was writing The Vaster Wilds before I started Matrix. And then I realized that they're really distantly floating parts, two parts of a triptych. But The Vaster Wilds came out of my desire to talk about the colonial period, especially in the New World, the effects of colonization, the ideas of nature on the human, and sort of the way that religion has taught us to see nature as an opponent as opposed to an equal.
So in an interview last year with Slate, you said that you wanted these novels to, quote, talk about the urgencies of now, which I thought was an interesting thing to say about two novels that are set in respectively medieval France and early colonial America. How do these two stories fit into a larger point about our contemporary world?
Yeah, I mean, there's no such thing as an ahistorical novel. Mm. All novels are historical, right? Every novel is a product of the time in which it's written, even if the writer doesn't even see that. But I believe in the historical novel as a sideways way of getting to examine the present moment in ways that are maybe more interesting, at least to me, than writing about like internet anomie, right? I mean, that's not interesting to me. I don't want to write that. And it's great when other people do it, but I don't want to write that. But I do want to write about the early seeds of the climate apocalypse that we're actually going through, right? Mm. I really want to write about the deep and urgent moral stakes of being a human in nature, right? And the way that our perceptions of humanity, our understanding that humanity, which has been given to us through every narrative we've ever been given out of the Bible, that humans are close to God and everything else is sort of below us. But I really want to change that narrative, right? That narrative is so poisonous and it's brought us to this point now where we don't see that a whale has as much right to live as we do, right? Or that even like a 100-year-old oak tree is just as beautiful as a human being. And so we need to protect as opposed to see nature as our opposition. I do believe that writers today, at least today, if I'm not engaging with the biggest problem that has ever faced humanity, which is the catastrophic climate change, if we're not engaging with that, what are we doing? We're screaming into the void, right? We have to engage with that. We don't have to engage with that through dystopian fiction, because I actually think dystopian fiction is a really weak tool to write about climate change. I wanted to write about the source of where we are now and how we can rearrange the narratives that we have taken into ourselves so much so that we don't think about them, right? We don't question the human-centric vision of the world enough.
So you mentioned earlier that Matrix and the Vaster Wilds are part of a triptych alongside a new book that you're working on. Can you tell us anything about the new book? And what are the themes that are going to connect all three of them?
Yeah, so the new book, I can't really tell you much about because I've written now, I want to say 15 different drafts of it from scratch, starting over again. And it's just nowhere near, I'm not wise enough to write it yet. And I may never be, and that's totally fine. Mm-hmm. Or I'm not able to listen to it enough because I'm very scared of what it's saying. Mm. It's about now. And what I want to do with the larger project, with first Matrix and Vaster Wilds and then this one, is to sort of see over time, like a stone skipping across the surface of the water, how the same obsession sort of manifests in different times, right? And bring us to where we are. If I can pull off this last book, which of course, maybe I can't, totally fine. I don't care. I do care, but I'm pretending that I don't. If I can, I want the reader to sort of see the same traces that are sort of being changed and modified from one era to the next to the next. Mm.
So you mentioned earlier your process, particularly when it comes to drafts. And I've heard that you often write your first drafts out in longhand and then put that draft away in a box and don't look at it again and then start the whole book over. How did that process develop? How did you learn that that worked for you?
Well, so I'm really just working with my own insufficiencies as a human being, and I have a lot of OCD. I mean, it's a big part of my life. So I needed to find a way to break the need to control and the compulsive need to control, especially sentences, because sentences are the things that I love almost more than anything else on the planet. So I realized that if I were to write longhand, first of all, there's more access to the subconscious when you're writing longhand, when you're not intending to reread the thing that you're going to put on the page. But also, there's this beautiful catharsis that happens where if there's something that you're really pleased about, right? Mm-hmm. If you feel personally like you did a really good job, your ego is involved. But if it doesn't stay from one draft to the other, it's just not meant to be in the book itself. I just learned this over a lot of trial and error and a lot of pain, actually. Like, I've never drafted on a computer just because I'm old enough that computers just didn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. I got my first one in college, and I'd already been a writer by the time I was in high school. So just writing longhand made more sense to me. But also, my thoughts are just much more intricate and interesting when I don't have that editorial voice stopping me when I'm not saying I need to spell this correctly. I need a period and a comma and a semicolon, whatever. So it's something about it brings me back to this sense when I was little that I could play, right? Mm. And when children play, it's serious. You know this. You have a toddler, yeah. right? They are deadly serious when they're playing because this is the way they figure out how to live in the world, right? And play is joyous, but it's also every time a child plays, they're pushing against the limits of what they can do. And so for me, it was just a liberation thing, honestly. I was liberating myself from expectation of being good, of even being coherent, right? I really love the process. I don't do it with everything. Sometimes, you know, I'll write a single first draft and then especially with stories, it's good enough maybe to try to put onto the screen. Mm. But with novels, I do this over and over and over again, really quickly in the beginning and then slower and slower as time goes on, because I really want to retain the sense of play, the sense of discovery.
And so how do you know what's going to stay for the second draft? I mean, do you have that confidence that you're going to be able to remember all the good stuff that was in the first draft that you want to keep for the second draft?
Yeah, it's not confidence. It's more like I have faith in the book itself, right? It's not about me, but it's about like the book telling me, reminding me what it needs. And I know not everybody feels this way, but I try very, very hard to step really far away from the book until the very end, when you do want sort of a super ego to come down and help you with the editing process and sort of more formal stuff, like the sentences and the way that the sentences need to unroll.
Right.
I have faith that with time and attention, which is love, right? Attention is love. The book will reveal itself.
So I want to ask you about where you think literature is going. This is an industry and an art form that has changed a tremendous amount over the last couple of years. And, you know, there are lots of writers who say that it's impossible to make money writing now. It's impossible to support yourself. There's also a lot of tension between literary fiction and commercial fiction, you know, and they seem to almost be going in very different directions. Are you concerned about the state of the book industry right now?
Well, the book industry is not the same thing as literature.
Yeah.
Right? The book industry is really the commercial aspect of the art form, which is so much deeper and stranger and more profound. I'm not worried about the books that people are writing and putting into the world. I'm so overjoyed to find how bizarre a lot of them are. They're going to continue to be. I mean, market pressures are bad, but market pressures don't mean that people are going to only write, you know, really compressed like commercial fiction, mm-hmm. which is totally fine. There's a place for that also. There will always be weirdos, right?
Yeah.
And there will always be people writing the things of the heart. I'm not worried about that. Mm. I am worried that there are so many people who are scrambling so hard just to stay alive that they're not able to put their beautiful work into the world. I mean, that is terrifying, right? And sad. But I don't know. I look at some of the really strange and wonderful stuff coming out, and I am heartened, actually, because it's going to continue to develop in the individual. I don't think we need to look at literature as a collective act in terms of the commerce, right?
Yeah.
It's a collective act only in that every single writer is sort of singing back into the melody of all the other writing that has come before.
So on that note, are you concerned about AI? Because some people think that AI has the potential to disrupt some of this or to, you know, fundamentally change the way we think about literature. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's classifying literature as the product, but for me, it's the daily work that really matters. And you can't cheat your way into the daily work, right? You can't cheat your way into the art. I think there will always be good readers who can tell the difference between something phoned in by AI and something that's really been struggled with and worked through and thought through and passionately and urgently attended to with all the love in the writer's heart. That art is human to human, and simulacrums of that can make entertainment, which is different from art, but it can't, I don't think, make art.
So I agree with you that entertainment is different from art, but can you explain for our listeners what you think the difference is between entertainment and art?
Yes, and this is very subjective, so they may not agree. It's totally fine. I think entertainment supports a lot of the given narratives that we have in the world now. It is a conservative thing in that it doesn't seek to shake the core of what we believe. Art is the thing that calls into question what we've taken for granted. Hmm. Art is the earthquake that sort of makes you stop and look at your life and wonder if you are doing something without thinking it through, right? Art is subversive inherently, and entertainment upholds the status quo.
Lauren, it's been so wonderful talking to you about your work and the insight your books give you into the forces that shape our world. And I've been so thrilled to learn so much about your process. But now I want to get to know a little bit more about the everyday things that shape you in a segment we like to call The Last Time. So, when is the last time you went camping?
Oh my goodness, I don't even know. Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, I do know. It was 2021, Thanksgiving, and my poor husband is too tall for the tent. Oh. So all night long, the tent was like beating against his head and his feet like a drum. It was amazing.
When's the last time you had writer's block?
I don't believe in writer's block, so never. I think that, there are times when we're supposed to be fallow and read instead of write.
Interesting. I love that. When's the last time you burned one of your manuscripts?
Oh, I did do that. I did that once. I think it was 2018. And every year on New Year's, my friend has a bonfire. And that year I just had to burn a manuscript because it was killing me. I was dying.
When's the last time you challenged your sister to a race?
Oh, that must have been... Oh, no. Well, she's, an Olympic athlete. So probably when I was a child and could beat her.
So now is she like, won a race? And you're like, no, thanks.
I would only challenge her to tennis, which I can play and she can't. That's the only thing I'd ever physically challenge her to. That's it. Everything else, she's got me really, really intensely.
When's the last time your sons did something that really made you laugh?
Oh, they're so funny. They're both hilarious. Okay, so last week, I kept finding a trail of toiletries all the way up the banister into the upstairs bathroom. And I finally asked them what was going on. And the older son said, because my younger son's so bad at morning hygiene, he was leading him like Hansel and Gretel out to with the deodorant first, then the toothpaste and the face wash.
Subtle.
Like, it was really amazing. It's actually very loving. It was very loving, right? Instead of forcing him to do it, he just sort of showed it to him.
Wonderful. Lauren, I cannot thank you enough for coming on this show. This has been such a fascinating conversation. I'm so honored to meet you. I've been a fan of your work for such a long time and really thrilled to have you on, so thank you.
It's been such a joy. Thank you so much, Charlotte.
You can find Lauren Groff on our 2024 Time 100 list, out now. Thank you so much for listening to Person of the Week. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love to hear from you, so send your tips or thoughts on our show to personoftheweek@time.com. I'm Charlotte Alter. See you next week.
Person of the Week is hosted by Charlotte Alter. It's produced by Nina Bisbano and Allison Bailey. Our senior producer is Ursula Summer. Our story editor is Katie Feather. This episode was mixed by Rebecca Seidel. Our theme music was composed by Billy Libby. Joseph Frischmuth is our fact checker. Person of the Week is a co-production of Time Studios and Sugar 23. At Time, our executive producers are Dave O'Connor, Michael Erlinger, and Sam Jacobs. At Sugar 23, our executive producers are Mike Mayer, Michael Sugar, and Liam Billingham. Sasha Mathias is the head of audio at Time. You can find us online at time.com/person of the week and wherever you get your podcasts.